Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. I'm Jeff Huser. I hope you enjoyed our last podcast, where Mike got a chance to talk with both ILM and Kerner Optical about Terminator Salvation, the detail that he got into with them, and the real differentiation between the crafts, but yet the closeness that the practical, miniature, and digital works together on a film like that. I found fascinating. I thought it was just a really good in-depth analysis. So if you did not get a chance to take a listen to that one, you might want to check that one out as well. Today, though, Mike's going to do the same thing with Transformers Revenge of the Fallen, really get into specific detail about shots and some of the challenges they faced. And to do that, he's going to speak with Jeff White, who is Digital Production Supervisor for ILM, on the show. So let's join them now as they discuss Transformers Revenge of the Fallen.
Can we talk about the film, I guess, from a technical point of view? Because there are so many things I'm interested to find out about, past, I guess, the more obvious sort of explosions and whiz-bangery. And, of course, ILM took the brunt of a lot of the shots here, and the robot count went up dramatically over the first film, didn't it?
Yeah, it really did. And, I still remember a year ago in May, the first time we traveled down to Los Angeles to look at some of the proposed artwork for the new characters, and there was just four walls full of new robots. And of course, that's always what you want to see. Like, that was really exciting, but a little daunting at the same time, because I knew from the first film how long it took us to create the 13 that we had, and now there were 45 new robots to build, and they were clearly much more difficult than some of the ones we'd put together for the first film,
yeah.
Both in terms of size and complexity, but also just, it's not always just about volume either. But for these guys, since in the first film they tend to range between 10 and 30 feet, and now they're ranging between 40 and 100 feet, that means that we've got to build a lot more parts to fill that area. And since we had kind of just barely made it last time, we had to come up with some pretty quick plans on how we were going to be able to put these guys together for this film.
So let's say we're looking at a new Transformer, one that is not, clearly somebody like Optimus Prime, but just a new Transformer that hits the storyboards. You know you're going to have to do a fair amount with it. They're not a back character, but then also not a lead character. How much is the design of the workflow influenced by the fact that it transforms, or is it two separate problems? Is it we need to work out how it's going to be an articulated moving piece of animation, and oh, by the way, we'll get a separate team to completely worry about how the darn thing transforms?
Yeah, what's funny and what we kind of discovered on the first one is that we couldn't really try and take that into account too much during the modeling process, or it just got too bogged down. And what we did instead is said, okay, here's its vehicle. Okay, make a perfect match of that. That's pretty straightforward. Here's the artwork for the robot. Let's go ahead and build that, capture the essence of the artwork and make modifications wherever we need to, as we're translating into 3D for what doesn't work. And then if it turned out in the script that it was going to be transforming, then we kind of figured it out in the shots. And that ended up being the most efficient way for us to do that work, especially because early on, the things change over the course of even the production process. Like when we first met with Michael, we weren't going to do a big Devastator transformation, and then that ended up turning into six separate IMAX shots of just focus on him transforming. So, we try and build it to get the form and the concept of the artwork, but then when it comes to actually doing the transformation, we tend to just save that for later work and shots.
So when they've transformed, or when they, in their robot form, there is not an energy, spatial conservation from the vehicle. I mean, Bumblebee is bigger than the Camaro, which is fine. I mean, it's completely the nature of the franchise. But how much does the design of the robot take into account any scale considerations for the transformed target? Or is it a matter of just saying, look, this is the concept art, and we'll just kind of make that work?
I think it's, you know, we definitely try and make it believable, and in that way not have too much appear that's wildly out of scale with the vehicles you just saw. And, you know, you can see that more in this film, like with Devastator, where he transforms from all these individual vehicles, but you can kind of see the different pieces slamming together to form his overall structure. And, you know, the pieces that are on the robots themselves reference the vehicles that they come from, but like you said, they're usually pretty drastically different in scale just because, you know, it's 15-foot tall, you know, vehicle turning into 100-foot tall finished piece. So what we do try and do is keep as many pieces consistent between the vehicle form and the robot form so that you really recognize which vehicles those robots came from. And, you know, if you look at Devastator, and he's comprised of six different vehicles, all the parts that make him up are lifted as much as possible from the composite vehicles that, that went into each of those limbs.
And yet they're not even the same kind of texture maps, right? Because, for example, we mentioned Bumblebee earlier. He has a kind of a worn, battle-hardened look in his robot form and a completely beautiful showroom finish in his car form.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was kind of an artistic choice on even stemming back from the first film where we built the original Bumblebee that, and it was just as clean and shiny as the vehicle that it came from, because out on set, Michael's got guys out there, you know, wiping down the cars continually so that he gets all the beautiful reflections and sun gleams and stuff like that off of them. But when we built the robots and we built them that beautiful as well, they didn't look real. And what we found is that by weathering them down with lots of chip maps and dirt and weathering, they ended up looking a lot more realistic. And in fact, it kind of played into the plot line of these guys have been fighting for many, many years, so in their vehicle form, in their robot form, they're supposed to be kind of battle hardened.
Yeah, and obviously it's a genre where you primarily want it to look cool and satisfy an audience for a story, which is great.
Yep.
But when we're talking about it from an animation point of view now, there is not a procedural piece of animation that's going to make a Transformer walk across the screen. That's done by a character animator, but of course with an enormous amount of controls that then links in, because that individual animator couldn't move every nut and bolt, every cog and wheel. How procedural does it get?
Well, it's interesting. It really has to be built up in several layers, you know, to give the animators control. And one thing that we learned last time that we spent quite a bit of time on this one was developing a pipeline for multiple resolutions of our characters. And that's a pretty straightforward thing and something that has been done for a long time, except the level of complexity for all our multiple resolutions is something that you could never do by hand because there's so many pieces. So what we did was develop tools that allowed us to take the high-res character and then have each piece kind of get sort of gift wrapped, like you would take like the upper arm and have a low-res piece kind of shrink wrap around that. And in that way, we actually built five different resolutions of every character. And in there, we could go from high resolution with every bell and whistle that that we could put into the rig, and then they would get stripped out and lower resolution all the way down to the pawn models, which allowed them to do real-time performance inside of Maya. So in that way, on this film, they were able to do much quicker blocking for shots and actually do a fair amount of the body performance on the very, very low resolution model. And then only when they needed to face and final tweaks, move up to the high resolution versions. And for characters like Devastator, it was absolutely critical because you really had, it was very difficult to work with that asset when the whole thing was fully loaded. So we split it up into six different assets, and the animators had control over, like, the head could be high res, but the arms and the body could be at the pawn level, and they could dynamically change that up and down through the course of production. And then we also gave the animators a set of tools where they could not only move every piece of geometry, but they could arbitrarily cluster pieces of geometry together in a particular shot. And they use that actually with great creativity. And what's nice is that means that we don't have to build a rig for every particular thing an animator needs to do in each shot. They can actually build rigs on the fly for much of the work that they need to do. And we were always continually impressed with what the animators were able to do with just those tools. You know, they would sometimes bring in, like, a fair number of the robots get damaged in this film. So they would bring in two or three copies of the robot and, you know, use the extra copies and bring pieces off those to knock off or maybe split pieces in half. They got really creative with that system in place. But what was nice is that then we didn't have to anticipate every single shot need. They were able to accomplish a fair amount of it themselves.
Because from a technical animation point of view, it's a pretty interesting problem because you've got sort of rigid body dynamics meets the sort of squash and stretch of what you want for a character animator. Was there tools there to allow, you know, to get that kind of what I'd call squash and stretch without breaking the individual pieces into being looking like rubber? Because at no point did they look like they were not metallic and solid, and yet clearly the arm and or the legs would compress during a run cycle or whatever.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Like, there were a few places where we had to bend pieces of geometry just to get the performance right, and you know, we never wanted to make an awkward performance just for the sake of maintaining perfect rigidity in the individual pieces. But we always tried to hide that behind something else so that the bulk of the metal that you saw on screen would all stay perfectly rigid. And then again, they had tools where if one piece is intersecting another, they could really quickly jump in there and just animate those individual pieces so that they slide over each other. And of course, we tried to rig them up initially and do pretty thorough calisthenics to make sure that as much as possible, pieces were all rigged up with expressions and dynamics so that they could slide over one another or avoid intersections as much as possible. But with as big as the fight scenes are on the film, it's just impossible to avoid intersections altogether. So then we'd have that ability afterwards to go in and clean those up.
So for those intersections, which of course, you know, is the bane of trying to make these solid parts have the fluidity of a fighter, was it a matter of like saying, okay, look, I've just done this animation, we've done a run where the computer's obviously done the fine detailed animation of bits and pieces, and I'm seeing some intersections, and I'm going to have to go in there and tweak them out? Or was it more the case that you never sort of saw them in the first place?
You know, what we'd sort of had a sliding scale on how important, how front and center those intersections were. And, you know, everywhere where they jumped out to us, especially on the first or second viewing, we would jump right in there and fix them. And, you know, it was always important for us for those not to become a distraction for the audience. And sometimes it was quite challenging because of how compact these robots are. Like, you know, Megatron got a complete redesign for this film. And he got much beefier, more rounded shoulders, and the pieces were packed even tighter together. So we had to work a lot harder to make sure that those things weren't intersecting. But, you know, in the end, we had actually a QC step after we finished and said, okay, this animation's final, where we'd sweep through and just look for intersections to go in and fix them one by one. But the thing that's interesting about the film is that some of the things you know, don't seem that bad are deceptively difficult as far as the technical animation goes. Like Megatron had, in this film, he had tank treads for legs. And those wrapped in, around, and all the way up his thigh. And so the initial rigging was quite difficult to put those together. And then we started animating it, and when we looked at it rendered, it was obvious that his thighs were a little too big. He just had these huge clodhoppers in the shot. So we then had to design another rig on top of that one, which would let animators dynamically scale the legs while continuing to make sure that the treads could run in, up, and around the shins and thighs and down around the toes.
I mean, is it the pain of your existence that there's going to be a Blu-ray DVD copy and people sitting there with a single-frame advance button?
I suspect so. I mean, I think, you know, people are such big fans of the property, and you know, it's really fun work to watch. Like, you know, I know for us in dailies, like, we'd sit there and you're just continually amazed by the work that people are putting together. Like, some of the transformations, even the first one that opens the film, it's Ironhide rolls in and he does like a, you know, 5-second on-screen transformation where the camera just goes around and around him, and, you know, there's so many details to look at and see there that you'll never see on the first pass through. So if people have the time to sit and enjoy the work that much, then we're definitely flattered by that.
I must admit, I've seen the film twice. I saw it in a 35 print and an IMAX print, and I found it at the yeah. IMAX print was the second viewing. I expected to get a lot more detail out of it, but at the size of the IMAX, it's so overwhelming, the visual complexity and depth to the shot. Was it one of those scenes like Shanghai, for example, when you're trying to build up in complexity, is it really now multiple teams coming together? And if so, how's the choreography? Is there a kind of a master? Because you've got sort of foreground, midground, and background action, but some of those actions yeah. are transformations, some of them are explosions, and obviously some of them are like just integration with live action.
Yeah, that's the beauty of working for Michael Bay, is he is the master of choreographing action. And he really knows how to stage those action sequences to get us the plates that we need. And he starts with really detailed animatics for what's going to be put together. And, you know, the animatic of the Shanghai sequence and the final result are not that far apart from each other. And usually modifications are only made just depending on, you know, what he sees when he walks on set and things that he thinks can, you know, get it to be a more exciting shot. But, you know, this film was a little different for us on a couple of sequences, especially the forest fight sequence and the bumblebee, I don't know exactly what he's called to the world, but he fights the guy with the chain arms. We called him Skipjack, but I think he's got a different name out in the environment. But those scenes had an original animatic, but because we were involved early on, we actually redid those entire sequences with kind of what we would take our next level of animation and fight choreography into account. And then we reviewed those pretty continually with Michael, so that by the time we went out to shoot those sequences, and particularly the forest fight, because it was in IMAX and in a difficult location in New Mexico to shoot on, we had a pretty good game plan for how we were going to get the plates that we needed and how we were going to get the staging that we needed to accomplish those shots. And what's nice, you know, if you have seen the IMAX version, is that forest fight sequence is actually, I think, 3 or 4 shots longer. And there's some pretty great choreography shots in terms of, you know, how the robots are fighting each other and how Optimus is kind of up and then he's down. So it was exciting for us to be involved in the production process that early. And a lot of times when we were able to be involved in shooting the plates and knowing what needs to be put there, we can really help stage the action so that we can get the best result when we get back to ILM.
The forest fight was one of my favorite scenes, and I think perhaps being a wimp, it was because it was actually slightly less characters on screen, and I was like more able to appreciate the choreography. I got to find out, though. I'm just desperate to know how much of the. I mean, like, if I was looking at a blank plate that you got from principal photography, are there trees exploding and falling over and smoke in shots, or how much of?
Yes.
Right. So it's a tracking nightmare.
Go ahead. Yes. I mean, I'm just amazed by our layout crew and how they were able to do those camera tracks, because they were IMAX tracks, you know, I mean, all IMAX plates that they were working with, and really, really difficult, challenging camera moves. You know, the cameras were up on cable cams, they were on cranes, like they never sat still. And ground contact in that sequence was so important. And if you look at the whole sequence, and actually you see more of it when you watch it in IMAX, we had to spend a lot of time going over our cameras again and again and our ground geometry to make sure that the feet were locked to the ground, to make sure that the characters were interacting with what happened there. And then on top of that, our Digimat crew provided us great. They painted patches of basically torn up ground that we'd reveal as the characters are sliding around, along with elements of dirt and exploding stuff that we shot on blue screen. And we had to shoot and scan all that stuff on Vista and scan it at 4K in order to hold up, you know, at IMAX resolution.
People think about IMAX and 4K as being, well, you know, it's bigger, but it poses a huge amount of logistical problems, not least of which is that, you know, the average monitor, if I can say almost all monitors, aren't able to display 4K. So, you know, you're sitting there, you're saying, trying to judge, say, whether something's tracking or not, but short of actually projecting it with some kind of high-end digital, and I really mean high-end digital projector, it's very hard to actually review 4K other than in patches, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, we generally found that we could get away with reviewing the full 4K shot in our theater, projected as big as we can, and we have the advantage of having the premiere theater at the facility, so that it's a pretty huge screen that we can go and review the work on, and that was really helpful for this sequence in particular in trying to evaluate how well it was working.
But imagine I was in your team working in the tracking department. I mean, I'm not going to have the ability to do that on a moment-by-moment basis. I'm going to have to judge it off my screen to get an eye track. Because, see, it was daylight. I mean, sorry, I'm just sounding sycophantic here, but it was daylight, it was smoke, there was explosions, and you could really see those feet landing in the dirt and not digitally skidding. I mean, obviously, they sometimes skid it around for creative reasons. But, you know, we, the audience, could really tell when it was planting and connecting, and it was working so well. I think it's so admirable that the team could pull that off with the IMAX stuff, because it was just, there was nowhere to hide.
Yeah, no, and that was the biggest problem is, you know, for every scene, it's sort of staged in these open fields of grass. And just, you know, the hardest, most difficult tracking problems you could possibly imagine. And it definitely took several iterations on almost every shot in order to be able to get cameras that really locked, and especially locked for all parts of the frame. Like, sometimes we would solve it, and we'd get the robots sitting on the ground and looking pretty connected to the ground. But then we'd start adding in all these foot slide patches and things that would pan off towards the edge of camera. And those would, you know, be right back into some, you know, occasionally we had to create special cameras for certain elements within a shot just to track those sections to lock to the ground. So it's something that usually doesn't get much recognition. So the fact that you notice, I think, is really fantastic. And I know our layout crew definitely appreciates that.
I think the other thing that's of interest, in an IMAX format, you're typically able to achieve a much, much shallower depth of field. You know, we can get an actor on an IMAX screen where they have, you know, almost their nose is out of focus and their ears out of focus and their eyes are in. And yet, of course, having shallow depth of field works against size because if we were to shoot a miniature, the one thing we wouldn't want to do is have any depth of field in shot. We'd want to be able to portray scale by having an infinite depth of field. So in these sequences that were shot on the IMAX camera, was there considerations to depth of field, or was it just whatever was playing well is what you went with?
There definitely was a consideration. You know, I mean, Michael's always looking at that when he's shooting his plates. And the thing that he kept emphasizing to us is just how, you know, shooting outdoors with these IMAX cameras, just how sharp and detailed the backgrounds needed to be. And where that really came into play is there were several shots, especially in the Devastator sequence, where we just didn't have plates that had the right camera moves for what we were doing in that transformation. So our Digimat team, using the virtual background techniques that we've been doing for a little while, and where we send a camera crew out on set, they get up on a lift, they've got a camera on a motorized rig, you know, that can shoot a 360-degree sphere, and they're all super high-res tiles. They put together these backgrounds, and, you know, for Michael, it was so important not only to have the background be crystal clear, super sharp, but also that we introduce a lot of foreground into those CG sets to help them make it look a lot better. And you know, that's the best part about working with him, is that he's a director. I mean, he could easily be an independent VFX soup if he wasn't already a superstar director, because he has such a phenomenal eye for the work and for understanding, you know, the best way to stage these shots. In particular, are all CG shots, which, you know, are always difficult, probably the most difficult to make look real. you know, giving us suggestions and working with us in terms of what the shot staging should look like. In fact, we ended up having to build this huge library of props just so that we could go in and set dress those shots to kind of match the surrounding shots that were shot on location in Palmdale and in Egypt.
Well, now, as much as I love the shots in the forest fight, my favorite shot is a trailer shot, and it's the devastation of the aircraft carrier at sea. And I'm presuming that was pretty much an all-out digital, for want of a better term, you know, fully animated shot. Was there any live action in that stuff?
No. There's, you know, of course, as much as we can, live action elements that we add in there. And what's interesting about that whole carrier sequence is that while we were shooting, we actually got to go out on set onto the USS Stennis and spend a few days out on the carrier, you know, which is something that it's like that's the kind of reality that Michael can bring to it because he's got such a fantastic relationship with the military. So when we were out there, we were shooting plates for VFX shots at the end of the film, but we also were able to just coat the boat with as many texture images, photo models, you know, all the reference that we could get because we knew that we went out there with the intention of trying to get plates for all those shots for as much as we could use. But there's two shots in particular, one where the boat or the carrier is sinking and it's kind of split in half and you fly right over the center section, and then another where it starts off on the tower and there's just all this debris and stuff sliding down the deck and transformers are crawling out of it, and then you go up and over the back of the boat and then the Fallen is hanging on the back of it. And pretty soon after we got into those, we knew those were going to have to be all CG shots. But the surrounding ones, the one right before that where the comets make their first impact, is actually a plate that we were able to use a fair amount of. And even just having plates of the real carrier benefited our all CG shots that we put together there so much. But that one was a pretty long journey in terms of developing the asset for the carrier, you know, getting the broken middle section. Then we also built that broken section as a pretty huge model up at Kerner Optical, and I should get you exact dimensions from Greg, but you know, I think it was over 12 feet tall and had all kinds of pyro elements and stuff that we shot on Vista cameras and used that for the kind of hero section in the center where the wound was, along with additional elements that we put in there. And then you know, digital doubles and you know, hundreds of rigid simulations of planes breaking and planes being flipped over and breaking loose. So, you know, by the time those were done, they were definitely long shots, but an incredible number of elements going into them. The second shot actually was kind of fun because we had shot elements up at Kerner Optical, but when we were going over the back of the boat, Michael had said, hey, you know, you need to get some soldiers in there and put some guys in. So we have a blue screen stage at the facility now where we set up a bar, and we got a couple of our artists to and a couple of rented flight suits and a blue screen, and just went down there and shot a couple of them on HD cam hanging and falling and stuff like that. And it was really fun because you know, it didn't require a big setup or shoot schedule. It was something we were able to kind of jump in and do very quickly.
Now, most of the attention, and rightly, is on the Transformers, but there's a large number of military planes in particular in this film, and many of them are real and many of them are, I'm sure, digital, but some of them hadn't really appeared on screen much due to restrictions from the military. Were there any issues in sort of, I mean, I can imagine if you had a major piece of military asset, you wouldn't want normally a lot of people photographing it in minute detail just for security reasons. How did that all work?
Well, you're absolutely right. Like, and again, like, you know, Michael just gets unprecedented access to those vehicles. And you know, when I was out on set, we were shooting on Holloman Air Force Base, and I mean, every day, I was like a kid in a candy shop because every day it was like some new piece of amazing, you know, military hardware between tanks. We were on C-17s, and we had F-22s fly overhead. They had F-16s fly overhead, and it was really incredible what he's able to get access to. And, you know, for some of the shots, it ended up working out really well. There's a couple of shots in the film of the Starscream jet, and in this film he's got tattoos. And Michael's able to get footage of real F-22s that he shot at the Air Force Base, and then all we had to do was actually just kind of graft the tattoos onto that real plate, and that made such a huge difference instead of having to, you know, to build out that full CG asset, to be able to just take the real jet and then just put on our tattoos. And I have to say that's, you know, the thing that I think we keep coming back to in terms of working with Michael is that, you know, out on set, he just, every shot is full of atmosphere, smoke, you know, pyro. I think the explosion that is in the middle of the film that I was on set for was, they've submitted to the Guinness Book of World Records as the biggest explosion on film, and it's really incredible. And the fact that he can get all that real explosion and smoke and pyro and interaction from these robots makes our jobs difficult in terms of camera tracking and comp integration. But at the same time, I think it lends so much realism to, you know, believing that they're there and that they're causing all these elements to happen around them.
One thing I wanted to ask you about was if we move now to the sort of Cairo Devastator IMAX sequence stuff, there's a lot of issues with these textures that we've discussed, but we haven't touched on motion blur. I'm wondering whether or not, because, you know, if you take an IMAX camera, and we learned this, I think, I remember reading an interview, I think in Cinefix, when they were discussing the original sort of Terminator 3D movie that went to the Universal ride, that they were moving IMAX cameras, and once the motion blur was added, the relative resolution dropped to effectively about, you know, sort of 1.5K. I was wondering whether or not, when you were doing these IMAX sequences, whether there was considerations to keeping it maybe a little less motion blurred than mathematically was correct, so you could sort of see what was going on and appreciate some of these detailed textures, or...
Yeah, no, absolutely. And in fact, it not even just limited to IMAX, because a lot of times we drop in our first renders and, you know, in an action sequence with both the camera moving and the robot doing some pretty, you know, gymnastic-like action moves, they tend to get a lot of blur and all the detail gets kind of mushed together. And it makes it much harder to understand what's going on visually. And, you know, for Michael, the things we kept coming back to are he likes his plates really sharp and, you know, really good contrast. So we did, both in IMAX and 35mm, end up reducing motion blur lower than what was mathematically correct in order for the shot to read better. And it was interesting because internally it was tough for us to do. You know, we use motion blur and this is how we make it look real. And we pushed it down and it ended up working. And, you know, it was another great example of where Michael tells us, like, hey, don't be afraid. You need to do this to make the shot look better. And we do something that goes a little bit against our grain and it ends up working out great.
Well, now you could do that in a film camera by just winding the shutter to a reduced shutter angle. Was the live action footage done that way to give you kind of, or was this more of a post decision where the live action was locked into the 180-degree shutter that was shot with?
More of a post decision where once we saw the plate with the choreography on top of it, that's when we'd make decisions about how much motion blur to apply to the characters. Because his number one concern, you know, and ours as well, is does the shot read clearly? And a lot of times with full motion blur, you really just couldn't tell what was going on. And, you know, as you know from seeing it, there's just so much happening in this film, it gets to be overwhelming. So we wanted to make sure that each shot in particular was as clear as we could possibly make it.
Well, now, I don't want to get bogged down in just, you know, arbitrary numbers, but there must have been some pretty decent render times on that IMAX Cairo stuff, because the level of the model that we've already discussed and the sheer size of the frame being four times the area of a 2K. I know you've got good render farms, but still, must have been pretty bad.
No, yeah, you're absolutely right. Like, and the thing is, like, what, you know, we had frames that easily took 72 hours to render. But it, you know, when you throw those numbers out there, it doesn't really take into account deadlines. And you know, when we've got you know, trailer deadlines or end of the movie deadlines where we've got renders that we know could take 3 to 5 days, it adds a definitely another kink in the schedule in terms of making sure that all the animation and all the elements that need to go into a shot are ready for those huge renders. And you know, a lot of times if something goes wrong, you end up just trying to patch together pieces to make it work in order to get a full take out.
It must have been a load balancing problem, mustn't it? Because to a certain extent, you want, I mean, you know, huge amounts of bad shots is one thing, but having the huge amount of bad render times all falling on the same weekend is impossible. So it must have been a load balancing thing to kind of spread it out over a month or three to just to get through it.
It was. I mean, you know, with Michael, we always like to joke because, you know, we finished the movie and we only had 5 finals. So everything in the movie is kind of in play all at the same time, and it makes for a pretty exciting end to the film. But, you know, at the same time, what we ended up having to do was, aside from the, you know, large render farm that we have at ILM, which is a lifesaver on this one, we had the other advantage of that there weren't a lot of other big films running when we were in our last, you know, 5 or 6 weeks of really massive render crunch. So we were able to really fill up the bulk of the throughput there. And additionally, we put together, or Jason Smith, our DPS, put together this hot pool, which allowed us, they were racks of machines. I think they were 8-proc, you know, 32 gig, super high-end machines that could be used to push through these IMAX shots that were on tight deadlines. You know, in particular, it wasn't even just rendering the robots that were so difficult. It was all the effect simulation of the pyramid smashing and all the dust and debris that comes off of that. You know, rendering, volume rendering all those effect sims is really time consuming.
Yeah, the effect sims add so much in terms of the realism, but they really add in terms of both the simulation, then the rendering, and also even just the tweaking, because, you know, it's sort of set it off and wait until it's finished to even work out where it's at. So was it in terms of just right to the nitty-gritty level, in terms of the actual Transformers and the metal shaders and stuff, ILM's done such great work from Iron Man to Terminator. Does the Transformer metalwork stuff, one of those boxes you just ticked, or were you still worrying about actual metallic shader type stuff?
Oh, I mean, you know, what's amazing is how much, you know, we kind of had figured a lot out for Transformers 1 and then, you know, started from that platform and worked up for this one, because what was different about this film is we had a lot of diffuse Transformers. Like, you know, on the first film, they were largely cars and jets and all pretty reflective and shiny. And on this one, we had a real mixture of shiny robots and then other robots like Jetfire, which was made out of the Blackbird. And that plane has the most incredible materials you've ever seen, because every single picture we looked at, you know, it was matte, then it was shiny, then it was somewhere halfway in between. So we really needed to work on our shader set in order to be able to accomplish some of the new robots that were in the film. And in particular, we really tried to push up the amount of layers that we put into these guys. So aside from just the base material, you know, we had chip maps, we had dirt areas where we had sort of clumped up dirt, and we had wet maps, like on Jetfire. On the Blackbird in particular, the pilots that we talked to told us about how when the plane takes off, it goes so fast, it actually separates, the panel separates a little bit, and fuel leaks out from in between them. So we painted these wet maps in between all around the cracks, so that as the spec highlights roll across that surface, you catch some really nice gleams in the areas that are right around the seams of the plane.
That's really interesting to say that, because, you know, I once worked on a military thing, and the problem was you traditionally age, you know, big machines that make them look. But the military keep their machines in such beautiful condition that you don't have kind of weather marks all over a. It's, you know, they are very, very well maintained, and consequently the classic staining and weathering and stuff that would be, I mean, obviously on the Transformers you could do all those chips and stuff, but you're not going to have that advantage when you're trying to do a digital version of the military stuff, because they're just not beat up.
Yeah, that is absolutely true. And you know, luckily with the Blackbird, it's such an old plane that it really did, you know, with all the fuel and all the, you know, around the engine compartments, you've got a lot of you know, output from the engines that gives you some nice smoke and some also heat treatment, some anodized metal. So you know, we looked for everywhere we could to add those weathering details, especially at a distance with our vehicles. You know, it's kind of like the classic digital double problem. When we've got those CG equivalents in there, you want to make sure they look good close up, but you want to make sure there's enough variation in the, you know, all the different maps that go into it so that it looks realistic, you know, even from a distance, which is, you know, most of where our vehicles end up getting seen from, since Michael can usually get the rear vehicles anywhere close to camera.
Just finishing up, have you had any feedback from the military in terms of, you know, how them being able to pick where you've moved between your stuff and theirs? I mean, like, these guys will know this stuff pretty well.
We don't hear from those guys too often about where we've gone wrong. You know, usually, like, we try and be as accurate as we can within the scope of making it fun for the movie, you know, so nailing every single detail isn't as important to us as making sure that, you know, it works for that particular shot or sequence.
But I imagine you made a lot of sailors on aircraft carriers pretty happy when they got to see the movie.
You know, what's interesting about that is when we flew out there, you know, Michael and Shia and Megan Fox all stay in the, I don't know, whatever staterooms they have, but the ILM guys and I we stayed down in the bunks with the crew. And, I mean, it was a fascinating couple of days out there. We got tours of every part of the ship and just found out these incredible facts about it. But when we were down there getting ready to go to bed, some of the guys were asking us whether we were going to sink the ship. And at this time, the trailer hadn't even come out. And, of course, we couldn't reveal any plot details. So, like, we're just gathering reference. But I'm sure once they saw the final film, they had a pretty good laugh at it. Although, if you look at the film, and, you know, this is the kind of details Michael's into, it's not actually the Stennis that gets sunk, even though it looks a lot like it. We changed the numbers of the call sign so that it's the Stennis at the end of the film that Optimus is standing on with Shia, and it's actually a different carrier that gets sunk in the middle of the picture.
Well, look, leaving aside the realism and the fans that I'm sure are in the military, from a general audience point of view, of course, the film's visual effects are as strong a feature of it as anything else, and it's obviously done blockbuster business. So congratulations. I think it's some of the finest visual effects work we've seen in a long time, and I just, again, can't begin to get over how your tracking department solved some of those problems.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the funny thing is it really had to ripple through every department in terms of upping their game, you know, in terms of our asset development crew. I mean, just to make 45 new robots was crazy, and then we had twice the number of character TDs, you know, for rigging on this film. And then lighting is so difficult because you can drop it in there and you can make it look real, but that's not usually enough for Michael. You know, he's got very specific aesthetic when it comes to lighting, and he's been lighting cars and you know, doing commercial work for years. So you know, we really have to get into that aesthetic and make it match. And then, you know, comp is incredibly difficult, and then all the way down to, you know, our roto department, which is usually underappreciated, but like the whole time that I was out on set and that Scott Farrar was out on set, we shot two blue screens for the whole film, and all the rest of the work in there is done through roto. And and it gets even more impressive when you think about doing roto at 4K, where they can only load one quadrant of the frame at a time and paint and roto on it. So, you know, just across the board, it's really phenomenal the work people are able to do on the film.
Yeah, and I mean, I was thinking about Digimat, like that you had almost every conceivable environment from underwater to outer space to tops of cities to deserts. I mean, there was like the range of environments that the lighting team had to match into, or the Digimats had to produce stuff for, was extraordinary. I mean, there really was just almost nothing I can think of other than maybe sub-Arctic conditions that weren't on screen.
Yeah. And, you know, what's interesting, too, like, we didn't have, I mean, we had very few, I think one or two shots. This was the first film with Michael where we've had all CG sequences. And, you know, that was a real learning experience for us because, you know, being on set, you see Michael shoots very fast. He operates the camera. He knows what he's looking for. He likes to get his hands on the controls. And it was difficult in the beginning with all CG sequences because we would stage it and animate the camera. But as you know, the first time you animate the camera in CG, it always comes out pretty spliny and smooth. And what we ended up having to do was build really low-resolution approximations of the set. And then Michael came up here. And we took him down on our motion capture stage, and we have a setup where he can hold a screen that's got a motion capture marker on it and basically get a view onto his set so that he can walk around the set and get the cameras and get the framing that he wants. And we put our rough blocking animation in there so that he could frame out each shot, and that really accelerated the process for us in terms of, you know, trying to get the blocking and the staging down in a way that he was looking for, because to do it just over a video conference where you can only draw in 2D is quite difficult compared to, you know, sometimes he just needs to get his hands on the camera in order to you know, get the look that he's going for in terms of the sequences. But you're right, both the underwater and the spaceship sequence, which was the arc nemesis for us, were quite challenging, not only in terms of camera work and, you know, capturing his aesthetic, but then lighting and just piling on so many real elements to kind of take the CG curse off of it. Because we'd get our renders out and, you know, they'd look pretty impressive, but then once we started putting in all the drips and all the gack and all the, you know, small particulates in the water, that's when it really started to work as a sequence.
Well, Jeff, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us. I really do appreciate it.
Oh, no problem. Happy to chat with you and enjoy the rest of your time in Japan.
Well, what Jeff was referring there at the end of the podcast was that Mike was in Japan for our training site, FX PhD. He was there with John Montgomery and Stu Mashwitz on a project to shoot one of the courses coming up in the term that's just starting now, a comprehensive guide to the new phenomenon of DSLR. Photography, cinematography. So using stills cameras, the Canon 5D Mark II, the Nikon D90, for example, to shoot actual work with. So they were over there filming some really cool segments. If you want to see some of that, preview of that, there's a Orientation Week video that we just put up on the FX PhD site. You can go right there on the front homepage, and at the top there's a link for the orientation video. Really excited about this term. Like I said, it's just starting right now. There's a bunch of new classes. RenderMan, we're going to have VPN access for students to the RenderMan software for the first time. We've also got a new massive class, storyboarding, previs, creative concepts and graphics designs, which is a kind of a new class based on crafts as opposed to a single application, the craft of graphics design. So that's an interesting approach we're looking at. There's also a bunch of returning classes, standards like Nuke, lots of Nuke classes, PF Track, grading in the application Color, getting a real good handle on color correction, Cinema 4D, of course, Roto classes, Red classes. There's a lot of classes. I'm even returning doing a Flare class, Autodesk's new software-only Flame version called Flare, class focused on Flare, but also looking at jump-starting artists who may have been using 2000 series software and not being able to stay up to date with the release cycle that Autodesk is on, very rapid, taking a look at 2010, the latest software. It's come with some of the new features, so that'll be fun to do. And that's all starting up over at fxphd.com. So for my partners, Mike Seymour and John Montgomery, thanks for joining us.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2008 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.